All right, folks, welcome to episode 3 of Quest for Peace. I'm Aya Zaktar. And if you've ever heard of me before, you might think, okay, why are you doing a show about Superman 4? And I'm not doing a show about Superman 4. I just liked the way that sounded, Quest for Peace. For a long time, I've been trying to figure out how to be content. If you've ever seen me on other shows, you might think, this guy is really angry. I'm not angry. I'm very intense. That's the word people use, and I've said that before. People who get to know me for all of about 10 minutes think intensity is the right word for me. But I pretty much was never really satisfied, and I tried to figure out why that is and how I could actually be calm. So for several years now, I've been reading a lot of different books and using apps or just trying to meditate, do a whole bunch of stuff to try to become content. And so what I'm doing with this show is I get to talk to people to see what techniques they use and how they stay so calm. Because most of the time, if you put any of the people that are on this show next to me, they will be considered the calm one most of the time. So let's get to it. Today we got Jonathan Strickland. Jonathan Strickland, if people have never heard of you, who are you and what do you do?
I'm that bald guy on that documentary 4 Days at Dragon Con, who talks about science fiction conventions. I've also been writing for a little site called How Stuff Works for 7 years, host a show called Tech Stuff that's in the top 100 on iTunes, host another show called Forward Thinking that's a really popular video series, and then I do a crazy podcast that is poised to take over the internet called Podcast Without Pretense with Aya Zaktar and Eric Sandin.
So that's the nutshell version of Jonathan Strickland, well-respected writer. I'm not sure exactly how we're running in the same circles because he's like here, real fancy guy. Knows everything about everything. That's why he's on this. He's a deep thinker. Let's start off with this. Do you consider yourself a peaceful person?
Generally speaking, I do. For me, it's actually been a pretty long journey. I would say that for me, it really the turning point for me from being filled with anxiety and stress and just, that was a Minecraft torch falling, and generally just being unhappy was due to being in the wrong career for a really long time. And I was making good money and I liked the people I worked with, but I didn't like the work I was doing. And it really had more of an effect on my happiness than I even anticipated. And so a big, big step for me was making a dramatic career change about 7 years ago is when I started working for How Stuff Works. And not that that magically made all the stress and anxiety go away, but it was the first step and was probably the most important.
Now, you are currently a senior writer and you host a bunch of shows. What was your previous career before you joined How Stuff Works?
Sure. Yeah. I worked in human resources management consulting, mostly in administrative support. I mean, I was really when I had invented a job title, I got interviewed by this consulting firm. They were looking for people who could really run sort of almost like a publishing side. They needed people who were really good at creating strong document layouts and presentation layouts for their proposals and their reports. So truly, it was administrative. I wasn't a consultant, but it was important because they needed people who were good at laying this stuff out, editing, proofing, all this kind of stuff. So I was part proofreader, part editor, part layout design. And like I said, I mean, it paid great, and the consultants themselves were really nice people. But I didn't find the work to be rewarding on a personal level at all. So I did that for 8 years total. And so when you think about it, I'm just now coming up to a point where my career as a writer is going to be as an equal amount of time in my life as my previous career in consulting.
How did you make that jump? Because a lot of people, when it comes to happiness, they stick to a job, they have stability, they want stability. And if you can get a stable job, that's always great, especially in this kind of economy. This idea of being able to go within and go, look, I won't be happy doing this. It might be stable, but I'm going to take a chance and leave. How difficult was it for you to shift? Because if you've been doing that for 8 years, it had to be sour at some point, but you were just putting up with it. how difficult was it for you to go, okay, this is not the way for me to be happy?
It was actually incredibly easy. My path, there's a bit of a blip that I have to address. So I worked for one consulting firm for 7 years. And then at the end of those 7 years, that consulting firm restructured. And during a reorganization, my position was eliminated. So they very helpfully pointed out that I wasn't fired. I just didn't have a job anymore. So not that that's much of a consolation for someone who goes through that. And anyone who's gone through that, who wasn't expecting it. I mean, I had been with this company 7 years at that point. I hadn't really thought about changing careers, although I wasn't terribly happy because of that stability. That stability is kind of it's a trap sometimes. And so I was stuck there, or I felt stuck there until they cut me loose. And then since I was unemployed, I thought for the first 3 months of that unemployment, I was really focused on trying to land a job that I really wanted to do. Just some job that I would always dreamt of doing, but had never gone out and tried. So I tried for 3 months, but it was just a terrible time. It was, you know, right after the holidays was when I was laid off. So we're talking January and February and March is when I was looking for a job. And after 3 months, I said, okay, now I'm looking for any job. No longer looking for the job that I dreamed of. I just need a job. And 3 more months of trying, I finally got a job offer, and it was from another consulting firm. So you can imagine the morale dip I experienced, because on the one hand, yes, I got a job and it was something I could do. It's something I had been doing. But on the other hand, it was more of what had slowly been making me less and less happy. So I started at the second place, but my heart wasn't in it. I had already tried really hard to land something I really wanted. And one of the places I had expressed interest in was How Stuff Works, but they didn't have a position open for me at the time. 6 months later, so this is 6 months into my new job, they contacted me and said, would you be interested in interviewing with us? And I jumped at the chance, because even though I had only been at this new job for 6 months and there was, again, stability there in the sense that it was paying well and it was work I could do, it wasn't where my heart was. So because of that extreme set of circumstances, because I had previously been unemployed for half a year while trying to land something, it was easy for me to make the transition. If I had been steadily employed, like if that blip had never happened, if I was still with that first consulting firm, I don't know that I ever would have made that jump on my own. I don't know that without that push that I would have done it.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that you basically got a little shove into moving towards a thing that made you very, very satisfied at How Stuff Works. For me, I mean, you've known me for a while. If you look at my resume, it's a constant shift. If I'm not happy, I move very quickly because I can't stand being unhappy. If my job is making me unhappy, or if my dogs aren't making me happy, whatever it is, I immediately try to fix the problems because I want to make sure that if I can whittle away all the things that are causing this stress, I can theoretically have a better life. But that's a whole other thing that goes into this. You're a writer. You've also been I know you do a bit of, I wouldn't say it's, I guess it is performance stuff. You go to like Renaissance fairs. You put yourself out there, and that seems like it's very scary. I mean, you're up there for basically criticism. How do you overcome that? Because I could see a lot of people out there just not taking that chance because they are afraid that they'll either be rejected, ridiculed, or criticized unfairly.
For anyone who wants to do that sort of stuff, who always wants to go out there and perform in some way, but they felt that limitation, my number one recommendation is to take look around in your area for theaters that do improv classes, specifically theaters that are known for their improv, because a good improv class lets you learn how to accept and even embrace the possibility of failure. And once you acknowledge that failure is something that sometimes happens, even if all the pieces seem to be correct going into something, once you accept that and you don't let that scare you, it really opens up the opportunity to do some incredible stuff. Now, in my case, I'm an extrovert. I mean, I'm naturally an extroverted person. And so I get a lot of my enjoyment just by interacting with people. And so that's the performance side of my personality is really just another part of that fact that I'm such an extrovert. And if you compare me against some of the other writers at How Stuff Works, you'll see a distinct difference. A lot of the writers are introverts. So they like to have their own little space. They like to have it be very quiet so they can focus on a task. And they can't have a lot of interruptions or else it completely disrupts their day. Whereas I'm the opposite. I need to occasionally get up and walk around and talk with somebody so that I can kind of refocus and get back to what I do best as a writer and as a podcaster and a researcher. So that's also a challenge, is finding the people at work I can interact with where I know I'm not disrupting their day, because I want to be conscious of that. But so the two parts of the answer I give is, if you're an extrovert, it's easy because it's pretty much just another part of your personality. If you're not an extrovert, then take something like an improv class, which will very quickly get you out of your shell, especially when it's a nice, small, enclosed class, because the pressure is really off. You know, it's just fellow students and a teacher who wants to see you succeed. So that, to me, is the best kind of environment to be in to sort of develop that approach.
Have you always been an extrovert?
Yeah. No, if you I think the very first show I ever did, I was 5 years old. So, yes, I've been a total ham my entire life. There are times where I like to have a nice quiet moment to myself. There are times where I kind of want to get away from the world and sort of rest and just relax. But generally,
we've got a bit of a frozen Jonathan there. Maybe we should reconnect with them. So maybe while that's happening, I'll actually mention a bit of backstory about myself, although Jonathan should hear this at some point. I used to be an introvert, personally. So I used to be an introvert a long time ago. I was a shy kid. I was a wisecracking person. You know, I made jokes a lot because I was heavy, I was small and heavy and shy. You don't really get much more like unpopular characteristics all put into one. That would be me. And so for some reason, over a course of years, I shifted from being an introvert into being an extrovert. It happened around college. I had a very kind of sheltered life. And so that's how I decided, okay, I'm going to kind of shift. It was actually in my college years that I changed from one thing to the other. The idea that being an extrovert, that that will help you be happy, I find it to sometimes be a little bit even more troublesome. I hope I can get Jonathan back to talk about this, because this is actually I want to see what his opinion is about this, because extroverts, they kind of feed off of other people's energy, right? So you have a bunch of other people around with a lot of energy, and that makes you feel good. But if you don't have that, it can be, I don't want to say poisonous, but it can be a problem, because now you're not getting your fix. Let's see. Do we have Jonathan back yet?
Not yet.
Not yet. He's somewhere in Georgia. I'm going to keep blathering on. Why not? You guys should know a little bit more about me and my quest itself. So I've been trying to figure out how to be content. And yeah, so right now, as Jonathan says, he had a total Skype crash. He's trying to relaying. I think that should say restarting or something. We'll see how that's going. When I was about 29, I was expecting my son. He was going to be born. And I didn't want him growing up with a dad who was basically unhappy. Like, that was one of the things. I didn't want to be this guy who hated his job and just simply did things for money and then went home and hoped one day I'll be happy. Because that, to me, just seemed like a life that wasn't fulfilling. I wanted to enjoy what I was doing. Because if you're going to be around, you're going to be breathing, why not be enjoying it? Okay, so he's going to relaunch. Jonathan's IMing him right now. He's relaunching. He's got a total failure. Okay, let me know what's happening. Keep me posted. Okay, so Jonathan will be back soon, hopefully. I'm just going to keep talking because why not? I'll just tell you a bit about me and why. Yeah, so I was trying to get this peaceful thing going, because if you're going to be a dad, you got to have infinite patience, and you have to have understanding, and you have to be able to, I mean, if you want to be a good dad, I mean, you got to have all of these characteristics. And I didn't know if I had those things, because for the rest of my life, there's going to be this human being that's dependent on me for advice and things. So that was a huge impetus for me to be a little bit, what's the word? It was more of a motivation to figure out happiness. And the weird thing is, I read a lot of books, I read a lot of blogs, and I read a lot of things. And one of the weird things was, I was reading all these things, but I was failing to practice this. One of the big things that I've been looking at is compassion. Compassion is a hard thing to have sometimes. You know, this idea that you, if you can put yourself in the position of somebody else and you can understand what they're going through, or at least attempt to, you might not be as short with them. You might be a little bit more understanding. So this idea that compassion for other people will make you actually happier. Sounds weird. This idea, if you can feel how they're feeling, you'll feel better. It's true, because interactions totally change with a bunch of compassion. And I needed to figure out how to be compassionate, because if I have a little gelatinous human being, I'm talking about a newborn, it's not exactly like something you want to deal with. They are screamy. All right. So we have Jonathan back, and I don't know if he heard anything I was talking about.
Not at all.
That's fine.
Sorry. You were
This is totally cool. I was explaining why and when I was going for my own quest for peace. I explained some whole extroversion stuff, some decent stuff. I'll just throw this at you, because I'm just curious what you think. Mm-hmm. When, as an extrovert, I was saying that basically we feed off. Like, I'm an extrovert now. I used to be an introvert when I was younger. But extroverts feed off of other people. And right. Without having that, doesn't that seem to – couldn't that possibly – give you more anxiety, because you don't have those people necessarily there to give you that support? How do you, and if that does happen, how do you get around that?
That's absolutely the case. Yeah. There are some great examples for this. Like, whenever I get involved in any kind of theatrical work, or like I was part of a group, a sketch and improv theater group for a couple of years, and we met regularly. And to me, that was great, because it helped re-energize me. I kept on having these regular social interactions that kept me very happy and kept me active. But that group eventually disbanded. It was just one of those things where a couple of key members of the group had to relocate. And as a result, there just wasn't enough there to keep the group together. And as a result, I didn't have this outlet. And it really meant that my stress levels and anxiety levels increased over time. Generally speaking, what I do to address that is either take initiative and invite people to do stuff so that I can have these regular kind of interactions with other folks. And most of my friends are also extroverts, so that kind of helps, because they tend to be the same sort of way. Or if I can't really do that, and for the last probably year, I haven't been able to do it as much as I'd like, because I've been so busy. I usually try a lot of meditation and kind of relaxation, like a lot of the white noise type stuff, or natural noises to listen to, and just kind of actually actively try to make my body calm down. So I do the whole thing from regular controlled deep breathing exercises to progressive relaxation exercises. And it all sounds a little hippy dippy in my mind, because I'm a very kind of rational sort of person. But when you do take that time and you address it directly, then there can be a measurable effect.
So you're into meditation. I'm also a rational person, as you'd call it. I mean, I have a bio degree. I have a couple of law degrees. So I'm a guy who thinks of things in, like, not absolute terms, but very logical things. When I first looked into meditation myself, I found that my brain was basically going every which way at any given time. And it was a lot of work to actually focus, or just like focus on the breath or whatever it may be. When you got into meditation, did you have the same trouble? And if you did, how do you, what would you recommend to people if they wanted to get started with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're doing it all on your own, and either you've, you know, kind of read a guide on how to do it, or you just, you know, you're just trying to give a try of just like, all right, I'm just going to lay down and do some deep breathing, or I'm going to sit back in a chair and close my eyes and concentrate on my breath. That can very quickly lead to deep breath. Got to pay that electric bill tomorrow. That thing I got overdue is getting, more and more behind. And then you just start getting into the cycle where any benefit you had is erased. I find that the best approach for me personally is to go with something that's already guided by another person. The first time I ever got into any kind of meditation was actually when I took martial arts classes. I took a class in jiu-jitsu, and the first 20 minutes of every class, these were like hour-long classes, hour-and-a-half-long classes, the first 20 minutes or so was essentially a guided meditation. Our sensei would have us all lay down on different karate mats and just relax, close our eyes, and then would walk us through relaxation exercises, because his philosophy was that if you're not relaxed when you're practicing these moves, you could seriously injure yourself. And so it was important to be nice and loose, and that this is something that was a skill that you needed to learn. When you have someone talking you through it, it's so much easier because you're listening to their voice and you just concentrate on it as the person continues to guide you. You just keep listening. You don't have your brain just spouting off at you because you're actually paying attention to what's going on. So even if it's not a live person right there to guide you, which is a luxury most of us don't have, there are so many different recordings out there on the internet that there's a good chance you can find someone out there who has a voice that you find appealing, something that's nice and soothing to you, and who is either following a script or is also just very adept at guiding people through this process. And I find those to be really helpful.
Yeah, not only just meditation. So the people, like I know for myself, like we were talking about being rational, you want to say like hippie stuff. It's always screams, you're a hippie or you're some kind of new age kind of person when it comes to meditation. And I found that the other way around that is basically you can have the same effect if you are doing something that completely takes up your mind. So for me, before I meditated, before I even bothered to do that or tried to, I was taking up indoor rock climbing. And the reason was when I started doing this as just for fun, there is nothing else you can really think about while you're doing this activity. Because if you start getting distracted, you're hanging off of a wall. So you better decide what you're going to do next. If you want to climb past this, if you're strategizing, it's this intense problem solving for me. And that actually made me very, very calm in the long run, because this idea of being fully engrossed. And there's a lot of tasks that you can do these days where you can probably do two or three things at one time. And having that split attention is actually part of the things that I found to be one of the things that was driving me nuts. And to slow my brain down, that was a lot of trouble for me, because It wanted to go every which way. Like if I'm, let's say I'm just cleaning the house, it's one thing after another. Now you're realizing you hate your house because it's got like a problem in the basement or something. And then it causes larger anxiety issues because it just kind of snowballs. And I think if people don't like this idea of meditation and they're like, I don't want to do it, find something that really, truly, you're only thinking about that one thing when you're doing it, whatever that might
Absolutely.
Be. And I find I always will promote exercise because it's got a biological effects for your brain. Do you find you are calmer with exercise?
I do. Yeah. If I'm more physically active, I tend to, in general, have a more positive, feeling, and I feel good about myself, one, just because I'm doing something active and I'm actually exercising. But then there are the other physiological effects that you mentioned that are real. I mean, those are real things, and I find that if I keep up with that, my satisfaction is really high up. The challenge there for a lot of people is just getting into that point where it becomes a habit, because until it becomes a habit, it's a chore. And so trying to not think of it as a chore and trying to think of it as something to look forward to, for some people, that's really hard to do. It's just, they don't associate things like being active or exercise as something that's positive, like a positive experience in the moment. They might think, the outcome is positive, but the actual process is not something I particularly enjoy. That's a big challenge to overcome. I find similar to what you're talking about, the doing a task that takes up all your attention I've got some ukuleles behind me. I actually find that practicing on a musical instrument kind of gives me that same sort of relaxation, because I'm concentrating very hard on things like chord changes and strumming technique and all that kind of stuff when learning a song or when rehearsing something that I've already learned so I can play it more skillfully. I find that also is very calming in the long run. Plus, I mean, it's music, so that also, for at least for some people, tends to have a very calming effect.
It used to be that I would do things that I found calming, like hobbies, right? So I would write, back when I was in law school, I'd write about technology just because I liked technology and it's something I wanted to write about. And people were looking at the blog, and eventually I made that a job as a writer. And then when it came to music, I like playing music. I've got some guitars and some computers, so I can actually put together tracks. So before I knew it, I was making this into work. I basically make all my hobbies into like jobs. And I realized that that was insane, because I needed something that could never become a job. And I truly believe that might be indoor rock climbing, because I'm too old for that to be some kind of, I'll be a sponsored person. That. So I recommend not turning necessarily your hobbies into jobs, but I mean, you have a passion for what you do. So, I mean, effectively, you wouldn't say writing was a hobby, was it?
Well, I mean, when I write fiction, I write some fiction stuff. Like I write for, I have a silly little video series I do with a friend of mine, and the writing I do on that is something that's totally different from everything else I do. Like my writing is nonfiction. It tends to be very heavily research oriented, and there is an entertaining factor to it. I mean, I want to make it entertaining to read, but it's not primarily meant for entertainment. It's usually some form of educational writing. So I do write for entertainment purposes in other, avenues, and those I find to be really rewarding too. In fact, I'm really happy when I'm being creative in that way. So if I am able to sit down, but I have to make myself do it, because I write so much already and I research so much that my first response is I would rather do something else. But once I get into it, once I start doing it, I am really, really happy. It's just getting out of the, getting past that initial feeling of, could I please find something besides writing to do right now? But once I do it, like I'll find myself spending 4 or 5 hours writing these silly little sketches and comedy routines and stuff. And then by the time it's over, it feels great. But again, when you're doing it all the time, it's kind of like what you were saying. When you turn it into a job and you're doing it all the time, it gets harder to find just pure pleasure in doing it. I was actually going to ask you, since in law school you started writing about technology, does that mean today you just sue people for fun?
No, I don't bother with lawsuits, and that's usually and I know no one ever believes me when I say this. Lawsuits are supposed to be the last resort for a failed negotiation, so I don't do that for fun. I don't do that for anger either. I don't sue anybody unless there's an actual issue. There's no ill intent there. So I've had some weird career stuff happen in the past. I don't know. 8 years I've been doing this. I've been in tech for 8 years, and my background has nothing to do with what I actually do. I got a bio degree, 2 law degrees. I've got a certificate from automotive repair. So The weird thing is, what I'm getting at here is why I went into this, and I want to ask your opinion about how you got into what you got into, is this idea of why not me? I started thinking about this in law school. I'd see folks on TV, or they were doing a show, or if they were writing, I'm like, well, those guys made it. What's stopping me from being them? I can work hard and become a video guy or podcaster or whatever it may be, a writer. What in your head said to you that, okay, you know what? I'm going to give this writing thing a go, and I'm going to work and be successful at it. What was the internal thoughts when it came to that?
Sure. When I first approached How Stuff Works before they were able to hire anybody, the thought was, this could give me the opportunity to do two things I love to do. I love to learn new things So at this job, I would be learning every single week because I'd be writing about how stuff works. And presumably, I'd be writing about stuff that I had never really looked into before. So the research aspect was really appealing to me. And then, of course, just the writing aspect. I've always enjoyed writing, but I never had that be any part of what I, you know, do to actually make a living. I mean, apart from rewriting some proposals or reports or something so the sentence made better sense, that was more editing than writing, so I didn't really count that. When the opportunity came up, I jumped at it because it meant that I could do this thing that I had been kind of doing on my own, but do it as my job. So, for example, I mean, I have always loved articles that were about how the world works. So everything from the blogs out there, like the Bad Astronomy blog that talks about, you know, Phil Plait really is, does a great job at explaining science and making it really fun and interesting, or the Straight Dope series of columns that publish in newspapers. Cecil Adams is the name of the largely fictional character that answers these questions. But there were questions that ranged on every topic. And I thought, I have an opportunity to be kind of like Cecil Adams. I have a chance to answer these questions about all sorts of topics. And when I started at How Stuff Works, I was a general writer. Like, I wrote about any topic that came up. And it wasn't until we had hired more writers and we started to specialize that they asked me if I would be the computer and electronics head writer, because I was the one writer who was not afraid of technology. You know, I've got a liberal arts degree. I have a degree in medieval English literature with a focus on Shakespeare, so not terribly applicable to the technology world. But I've always loved technology. And actually, in my opinion, technology is the best subject to have if you're going to explain how stuff works, because there's a very definitive way of how it works. It's actually the easiest of all the subjects to explain because it specifically has a way that it works. And once you understand the fundamentals, you know, once you know how ones and zeros move around, it, the rest of it's pretty easy, you know, at least on a high concept level. So all of that was going through my mind all the way through becoming the technology writer. They approached me about doing a podcast. And at that point, I had already been a fan of other podcasts. And I thought, you're going to let me do this thing that I love listening to. That sounds great. I'm happy to do it. And also, I mean, I had experience doing radio theater work and also, you know, stage theater work. So it seemed, that seemed like fun. And then I ended up pushing for us to do more video. Because once we got to the point where we were doing podcasts, I thought, well, why should we stop here? We should definitely be doing some video content as well. And I pushed for a few years before we really started doing that. And then if you've been paying attention to how stuff works over the last year or so, you've noticed that we've done a lot more video now. So I'm really happy about that. So in the first two cases of writing and podcasting, it was really about jumping on opportunities as they arose. And video, it was about making the opportunity happen and not giving up on it.
It's weird. You're saying the word opportunity. I'm thinking it's almost like challenges. Like, you're setting up challenges for yourself. You're trying to take on a topic that people don't want necessarily. You have a degree that doesn't really back up what you are actually doing. So you're giving yourself a challenge to overcome. Did you ever think of it that way, or are you just thinking of it like, oh, well, I like tech and I happen to be a Shakespearean guy, but eh.
Well, I mean, you know, when you think about it, if you have a degree in literature and you are doing all this writing and research about various authors, particularly if we're talking medieval and Renaissance, you're doing extra research because you're looking at an archaic language that doesn't necessarily resemble our own, at least not on a surface level. There's a lot of research that goes into that and a lot of synthesis that goes into that, where you have to really understand what the subject matter is before you can say anything else about it. And really, when you get down to it, the stuff I do for How Stuff Works is the same way. It's all about researching the subject, understanding what it is, and then being able to frame it in such a way so that you can explain it to someone else. I always told people that my challenge was just to understand a subject to a point where I can turn around and explain to my mom exactly how that thing works. And if I'm able to do that, like just start with a basic explanation and then get progressively more complex, then I know I've done my job. That being said, my mom is actually incredibly intelligent and savvy. So it's probably not the best example, but you know, it's the one that people latch onto. I could say, you know, my grandmother or something along those lines. But yeah, that was kind of how I looked at it. I never thought of it as a challenge so much as an opportunity because, again, I developed the skills of research and writing in college. And this was a chance to actually exercise them in a professional way. And also, I just wanted to do it so much that if you had told me that this is challenging, I probably would have just laughed it off because not that I thought that it was, you know, this is easy, but rather this is what I want to do.
See, for me, I found out I liked challenges much later on in life because what would happen is when I would have an experience I hadn't had before and I was actually starting to get nervous. Explained this last week to Tim Stevens. When I got nervous, for some reason, that actually made me feel more alive, that this thing I was about to do, it was going to be something I hadn't done. I'd have to actually just come at this in a way I've never done before because I don't know how to solve this right away. I have a bit of rational belief in my problem-solving skills, so I can probably figure something out in the long run. But it was in being almost petrified, scared. That's when I was most excited. And then apparently that is why I started doing all these weird things like doing video stuff. Like, I mean, this is doing video work for me was challenging because one, I'm from the East Coast and I talk really fast. And dear gosh, if people told me to slow down. So a lot of criticism in the beginning. And God knows you have no idea what you're doing in the beginning. So you're going to do a lot of bad work, a lot of bad work. And the thing is, you got to keep plugging at it. And for me, the challenges are actually the exciting part. And the other thing is expanding what you actually are looking at. Because for like I probably wouldn't be looking into meditation if I wasn't willing to go, all right, you know, this seems like a hippie thing, but I'm going to give it a try. I mean, there was one day where I this is an odd story. I moved into my apartment. Somebody knocks on the door. It's three Mormons. And they're trying to convince me to join them. And so I'm standing there and I'm like, you know what? These guys look happy. I'm going to listen to you guys. Go ahead, just start talking to me. So they start telling me this stuff. I talked to these guys for about half an hour. I want to find an answer. You know, I would love to be able to just to believe in whatever everybody else believes. Now, I didn't join their I guess, section. I didn't join their faith. I'm not that kind of person. Have you ever found yourself in that kind of area where you're like, you know what, I'm just going to try and listen to anything to see if any of it makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a natural sense of curiosity. So if nothing else, I've approached it sometimes to think, sometimes in a way of I want to understand what other people believe in order to get insight into their personalities and behavior and the things that guide their decisions. So that tends to be almost more of a scholarly approach as opposed to any kind of personal fulfillment side. I kind of established my own philosophical point of view probably, gosh, I don't know, maybe almost 20 years ago now, and it's pretty much stayed the same. So I mean, I've always been interested to hear what other people find to be fulfilling, but it just has never really applied to me directly. I'm very much like you in the same way, very much a kind of a rational, logical approach to things. And that has meant that I've essentially turned away from these other kind of established, particularly the established religions. I just I don't find much to identify with them. I love the... There are some of my friends who are very, very religious, and many of them are truly inspiring to me because they don't just, you know, attend a service and then, you know, that's the end of their relationship with their faith. I've got a friend right now who is preparing to go to Ecuador for 2.5 years to join the Peace Corps, and it's really because she truly believes and sacrifice and helping others and giving her time to serve others and to make other people's lives better. And I I draw inspiration from her and her decisions. And she's young. I mean, she's significantly younger than I am, but a very good friend and a remarkable human being. And so I find inspiration from those people, even though I don't share their same, you know, worldview, at least their religious philosophy. So I haven't really explored that on a personal level at all. I kind of closed that book, like I said, about 20 years ago. But I certainly don't, you know, I know there are people out there who are constantly in search, and when they find something, it's really fulfilling for them. And I don't begrudge them that one moment.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask you something. Now, we talked about trying new things and you used the phrase embracing failure. If you had to tell people how to handle that, what would be your advice to people in embracing failure? Because that's the way you either find happiness or you don't. You got to keep trying lots of different things. How would you advise somebody to say, you know what, you might not succeed all the time, but it's worth it?
Well, I tell people that the way to success looks – all right, here's how we often think of success. We think of a pathway, and there are two branches. And on one side is failure, and on the other side is success. But that's not the way the real world works for most of us. The real world works like a long pathway that goes and meanders, and it's failure, 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 success. And that's what you have to keep in mind, is that in order to succeed, you pretty much have to fail first. You almost always learn from that experience, and you always are going to learn more from a failure than you do from a success. I mean, that's even the basis of the scientific method, is that we learn from things that don't work. And if something does work, it really just confirms the hypothesis. We don't learn anything from that. We just confirm something that we had suspected. It's when the hypothesis does not hold true that we learn there's something new there that we have to find out. And if you just even embrace that on a rational level, then I think that it works perfectly well. But emotionally it works. I mean, if I were to actually write down all the things I've attempted that didn't work out, it would be a pretty long list. But I'm still really happy because by trying those things, I got to where I am now. And it's really remarkable.
Yeah, it's definitely, don't be afraid to fail. Don't beat yourself up necessarily. If you can take lessons from it or use it as motivation or just figure out what exactly happened so that the next time you don't fail. I mean, it's going to be these constant revisions until you get somewhere. Excellent point bringing up the scientific method when it comes to that. This idea that you are working as a goal, there's going to be a mistake or two in there. But it's not the end of the world if you screw up. Trust me. I've been through lots of screw-ups. So I think it doesn't matter what it is. It's kind of like sometimes the way I think about workouts, the idea that a crappy workout is still better than no workout. Same thing with failing. Like if you tried, you know, the attempt is better than not trying at all. So just go for it. I still don't know if we should. Do you want to promote anything, Jonathan, when we're saying goodbye?
Sure. I will promote one thing. Soon to be at Monday nights, you can tune in to Podcasts Without Pretense. And I promise you, we will fill you with anxiety and stress.
Yeah, that's a different side of us. This is why you will hear Jonathan constantly say that I'm a very angry guy. Now he knows I'm not. I'm not really angry. But I do hate everything, and you will find that out on that show. We do that show together.
To be fair, I pick really bad movies, so I'm just feeding into the hate.
Well, see, that's the thing. Like I said this before, I think hate is such a strong word. It just requires so much energy to hate something. Like, I don't think I have that much energy to hate. Like, I'm just kind of like, yeah, I mean, I don't like it, but I'm not going to be like, okay, I'm still really mad about that bus stop that didn't have, you know, an enclosure and I got rained on. It's like, that's a lot of work. I don't want to, yeah. Like, I'm late. I don't want to hate. Anyway,
yeah, it's too active.
Exactly. Passiveness is the key. I'm going to wrap up with a little saying I found somewhere, which I can't remember. I should totally attribute this to somebody, but I don't know. I'm stealing it entirely. So it was to find peace. There's no strength without balance. You got to find balance, whatever that might be for you. I'm trying to find balance in lots of different ways. Work, friends, just life, trying to get that all in order. If you can find balance, you might be happy. So good luck with that.